The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Like those unpleasant memories of your ex who just wouldn't pick up your calls, you are now Skeptically Speaking, where we normally ask you to call in and question everything. But unfortunately, our ex canceled our phone bill, sold the car to a homeopath for a dollar, and threw all of our clothes over the balcony into the streets below. And pretty much all we have left now is this email account. So for tonight, we'll just ask you to mail in and question everything. And with all that in mind, I do present to you tonight your hostess, Desiree. Take it away.
Thanks, Sean, you dork. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, all. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Ming Su about neuroeconomics and why and how your brain makes these sometimes strange decisions it does. But before we get to that, we have a special guest here for Speaking Up. Jill Powell, one of the lovely skeptics, is in the studio to talk about skepticism in movies. And for anyone that's been living under a rock, welcome, Jill, and what is skeptic?
Hi, Des. Skeptic is basically a group of women and one deserving guy who write about science, skepticism, and pseudoscience. The website was founded by Rebecca Watson and started out as an online magazine. And then in 2006, Rebecca decided to start a blog called Memoirs of a Skeptic. And then in 2008, she enlisted the help of 14 people, myself included, to help out with the blog with writing and promoting the website.
So Rebecca Watson, for anybody who doesn't know, is one of the wonderful people on Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Yes, she is.
All right. So Jill and I were on Twitter last week, and Jill posted the trailer for a movie that's coming out today. It's called The Skeptic.
Ooh.
And she had, I would say, a visceral reaction to the trailer. Can you tell us about it?
Well, yeah, I came by this trailer completely by accident. I was prowling the Apple trailer website when I saw it, and I had to click on it. And I kind of wish I had it now because it made my head explode. Basically, the preview starts out with this guy, the skeptic, who inherits this house from his deceased aunt, which, as a side note, it's a Victorian house. It's always a Victorian house. Why can't he inherit a duplex?
Nobody
really
inherits it. Like, duplexes, no. No, they got
it's
nothing.
Always.
Would you be happy with a duplex?
No, but okay. Really, if you're going to do a movie, do it differently. Like, seriously. Anyways, it's creepy, and he meets the town folk, and they all think that the house is haunted. And of course, being the skeptic, he dismisses it, and you know, that's like crop circles, which is a direct quote, by the way. It's just like crop circles. And then weird things start to happen, like he gets locked in a closet, he hears voices, a rubber ball falls down the stairs, and he sees people that disappear. And immediately he's like, I'm getting haunted. Now, if he was truly a skeptic, maybe he would think, am I getting enough sleep? Am I going crazy?
Have
but
I
no.
taken my meds?
Should I call Joe Nickel to see what's going on here? But no, he calls a psychic, who, as we all know, psychics are very reliable with their information, except for the times when they're not, which is all the time. They are not right at all. So this psychic tells him that, oh, something bad happened in this house, and something supernatural is happening, and he believes her.
Skeptical.
Yes.
Good. Okay.
And, yeah. I mean, if this guy's a real skeptic, like, where's the evidence for this? Why isn't he asking her questions? Like, how do you know this? He just goes along with it. It boggles my mind. Like,
and I, you know, what's funny is we officially have probably talked about this trailer for longer than the trailer actually is.
Yes.
I like that.
Yes. So I wonder if this is how Hollywood thinks skeptics are. Like, we're skeptical until we aren't. Like, we will be swayed by no evidence when we thrive on evidence. So this trailer kind of hit a sore spot with me.
Well, and that's kind of interesting, because as a skeptic, I would think if I thought my house was haunted, who would I phone first? Would I phone a psychic or would I phone a psychiatrist?
I would hope that you would phone a psychiatrist.
Okay. So is this kind of typical of what Hollywood's doing?
In the majority of music movies, yes. Like, skeptics in movies are generally summed up in, like, they're boring, they're arrogant, and they possess the ability to completely disregard any critical thinking skills that they may have acquired in their life because of something that's happening that they can't explain.
Which is interesting, because if we look back at the definition of what a skeptic is, this is entirely unlike what a skeptic is. Okay,
yes.
Okay, good. Okay,
And the message in these movies that represent skeptics or atheists is, don't be so skeptical of the supernatural, but that should be followed up with, if you're living in a magical land, like, there should be a disclaimer there somewhere. And in the same vein, especially with this movie, it's assumed that if you are skeptical or an atheist, something tragic must have happened to you to make you feel this way. And I'm not saying that that's not true, that there are cases of that, but I don't think that's the majority. Some people just don't believe in God, period. Or they want to see the evidence first before they come to the conclusion that God or some supernatural being did it, and their case closed. So, it just, yeah.
If everyone could see Jill's face right now, I think consternation is the word I'm looking for. Okay, so actually, you were talking, Jill and I tweeted back and forth about this for a long time.
Yes, we did.
The reaping you mentioned, this is another example of it.
Yes, the reaping is kind of what I was saying before with the something tragic happened. Hilary Swank is in this movie, and to this I say, Hilary, did you need a paycheck that badly? Really?
Can you say contractual obligation?
She is investigating this town that's being plagued by, well, the seven plagues, and they are convinced that God is raining down these plagues. And she, in each situation, she does not have, like, the River of Blood, for instance. They don't test the water to see if there's blood in it. They just, okay, it's blood. Like, wouldn't you do a test for that?
At least they didn't taste it. I've seen that in movies,
yes.
You know, where they have to taste the thing, but they don't know what it is.
Exactly. And then you find out that she used to be a missionary. And then the tribe's people that they were doing their missionary work for sacrificed her family for rain. Therefore, she has no beliefs whatsoever.
Okay, so well, that's depressing.
Yes.
Okay, so that's skeptics and atheists in the movies. Are there any positive representations at all?
In movies, they're making strides toward it. But more so, I think the positive representations are in television. For example, on House MD, there's House.
Absolutely.
He wants to solve the medical puzzles. He wants to find the answers by any means in scientific terms. Plus, which is a bonus, he's fine. And that's good enough for me, right?
Actually, and that's another point, is usually the, you know, the skeptics and the atheists, like real skeptics, that the ones that, you know, stay skeptical or atheist through an entire movie and nobody dies, are usually kind of unattractive.
Yeah.
So
basement dwellers.
Really? So that's nice. House is hot.
Yes, House is hot, and he might not be the most pleasant person to deal with, but you know, it balances out because he's good looking. Anyways.
And so is that what we want to see out of skeptical representations in movies?
I think we would want to see,
maybe someone who's not so douchey.
Yes.
Not that he's just not hot.
No. But like with the movies, there's one end of the spectrum, and with House, it's the other. I would think you'd want to see something in the middle. Maybe a little bit of douchiness, but not a whole crate of it, as it were. So, but I mean, another example would be Lisa Simpson. She's a cartoon character, but she is a good role model, and I think especially
Absolutely.
For kids, because she has a lot of critical thinking skills. She's logical. She just stands by her beliefs no matter what.
And she was reading a Junior Skeptic magazine.
Yes.
In one episode.
That's right.
I remember that.
So I think that is a great representation.
Velma
from Scooby-Doo.
Velma. I love Velma.
Oh, definitely.
Always looking for the scientific explanation.
Yeah.
And they're, but again, you know, Velma and Lisa, not as cute as they could be.
Yeah.
Really.
It's true, but they're cartoons.
I know, but I'm just saying.
But I do have an example in a movie, in Garden State. Natalie Portman's character casually mentions she's an atheist, and guess what? Nobody dies. The movie continues. Zach Braff continues to be neurotic. Nothing stops from that. And I think that's what movies should be. Like, if you're going to... It shouldn't revolve around that belief, like you're a skeptic or you're an atheist. It should just be a part of the character. It shouldn't be a movie central to it, is basically what my point is.
Perfect. Thanks very much, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Wonderful. Jill.
All right. Now, next on our list today, we have Brownie in Motion.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. That was great to hear from Jill. She's one of the people that I like to follow on Twitter, and her tweets are always sometimes they're sad. Oh.
But they're often about pillow fights.
But they're often about, which is hot. That's awesome.
Totally hot.
Hey, you guys opened it up with the whole Hugh Laurie thing. I remember seeing a video on YouTube somewhere, something about back when Hugh Laurie was still English, and... Well, because he used to be, yeah. I mean, he used to have a comedy show, and I can't remember what the show was, but you can... It was which?
A Bit of Fry and Laurie.
That's right, Fry and Laurie. And it was A Bit of Fry and Laurie, and it was absolutely great. But I saw the two of them were on some particular, they were in the audience somewhere, and there was a psychic who was doing cold reading, and tried to read them, and just happened to pick up Hugh Laurie, and started going through and asking him, and it was great because Hugh Laurie had this sort of stoic. Yeah, no, I'm sorry, you're kind of way off. Although he did suggest that he was a very personable guy, and the fact that he was a television persona, I thought, was a kind of near hit, but Hugh Laurie was having none of it. So actually, the first thing I'm going to do is I got a piece of fan mail. Strangely
Yay!
Enough. Although it wasn't really so much fan mail for me on the show, but through... anyways, it's a cartoon drawn by the son of a friend of mine who's a budding young... I was skating with him and his brother way back in the winter and at Horlack Park, and there were a couple of skate lines, of course, going across the ice. And where we were standing, his head was making a shadow, a little round ball over some of these skate lines, so the ball was bisected. And he turned to me and said, "Look, my head's like a Venn diagram." I thought, oh, that's so awesome. That was just awesome. But anyway, so he's 10 years old. His name is Patrick, and he's drawn me this cartoon. It's called The Catholic Funnies. And starts off, there's a priest in front of a pulpit, clearly a Catholic priest, who says, "What shall we ban today?"
It's 10, right?
Yes, a 10. The next panel he's got a great sense of perspective, and there's a great progression of tension in that. The next scene is sort of a top down of the congregation, and a talking bubble still coming from the priest. "I have found," and then it's a close up of the pulpit again. "Witchcraft." In the very last panel, it moves from in church to at Hogwarts, and there's unfortunately poor Hermione on a skewer being slow roasted. Burn, Hermione! So anyways, thanks a lot for that, Patrick. The Catholic Funnies is absolutely...
That doesn't translate as well on the radio.
Yeah, I'll ask him cute. If I can scan it. It's just gorgeous. I loved it. So I was really happy to get that. So the other thing is, of course, everybody in Alberta is all apoplectic about Bill 44.
Absolutely.
The Human Rights, Citizenship, and Multiculturalism Amendment Act 2009. And although I do have to say, I will say off the bat that there one good thing about it is that it amends that all the things you're not allowed to discriminate against people for, and it previously said race, religious beliefs, color, gender, physical disability, mental disability, age, ancestry, place of origin, marital status, source of income, or family status of that person or member. And they've amended each instance of family status to family status or sexual orientation.
Lovely.
So that's kind of a win, especially here in Alberta. In fact, that's a big win.
But buried within that, Bill.
But buried within that is the drawback that they go on to talk about the notice to parent or guardian. And it goes, "A board as defined in the school act shall provide notice to a parent or guardian of a student where courses of study, educational programs, yada, 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 prescribed under the act include subject matter that deals explicitly with religion, sexuality, or sexual orientation." And then it goes on to say that the board must notify parents of any kind of subject matter that's being taught to that, and that parents can write in, send their kid with a note, and let them opt out of that portion of the class, whether they leave the classroom or just sit there and don't take part. And, I mean, on its face, I mean, what are you going to deal with in a science class that deals explicitly with religion? Well, nothing for most of us, except there happened to be a huge religious contingent that seemed to think that evolution somehow infringes upon their religious beliefs. And so for some, it does. For lots of others, it doesn't. That's fine. But what... I think Stelmach actually came out in an interview and said, yes, that would allow parents to opt their children out of the teaching of evolution.
So what does this mean?
It means that we now have allowed parents to choose what it is in school that they think their children should or should not be allowed to learn. And on the face of it, that sounds all right. But you've got to think, we do have a lot of protections for children against the decisions that their parents make. And I think that some of them are reasonable. Some we don't even question. You can't leave the hospital with a baby unless you've got a certified child seat. There are all sorts of things that you can't do. And, I mean, I'm not a parent, so I would probably think differently, and me being an opinionated, obnoxious ass would probably have a different opinion anyways. But nonetheless, I mean, we sometimes have to protect the rights of children against the wishes of their own parents, absolutely, even though those parents may or may not be well-meaning, but just might be downright ignorant.
Like, this is about protecting the rights of children to an education as
yes.
well.
Yes. And regardless of what people hear, or particularly this small but vocal contingent of religious people that have a real issue with evolution, what they don't understand is that they're cutting their children off from all sorts of career and educational opportunities. I mean, disagree with the theory all you like. However, the rest of the world has no problem accepting it, especially with all the wealth of evidence and the peer-reviewed scientific literature that supports it, which, like all other facets of science, there's tons of peer-reviewed research, but, I mean, it's as often pointed out, people don't freak out about their kids being taught gravity and that whole secular hoo-ha. But, I mean, what we end up seeing is that children that grow up in communities like this where they're not allowed to, or where they aren't given full grounding in science, find a hell of a lot less... there are a lot less, fewer opportunities for them to pursue further education. It's harder for them to get into university. Sometimes they've got to take remedial classes. Instructors don't know what to do with this because you've got these kids that, well, they've just never been taught the basics of all of this sort of stuff. And so, anyways, it's hugely problematic. So, what I'd encourage everybody to go out and do is it's easy enough to find. If you just Google Bill 44, Alberta, what is it called? Human Rights, Citizenship, and Multicultural Amendment Act. Feel free to read it for yourself. But write in, email, phone, whatever it is, however you contact your MLAs, they're easily found on the Alberta government website. Find them, tell them what you think, let them know.
And Brian Mason actually mentioned this in the legislature, on Wednesday and today. I'm not sure.
I believe so. Yeah, I didn't get a chance to hear his talk. Unfortunately, I was at work.
He had a lot to say about it. He's very against this bill. So.
What did he say in particular?
Basically, he was just trying to force the conservatives to actually say that people wouldn't have to attend classes on evolution, but didn't quite get that far.
Great.
But definitely he's pushing the issue.
Was it Brian Mason who said we're trying to look like Northumberland and Arkansas all at once?
What was the exact phrase? We seem like Northumberland and we act like Arkansas. That's hot.
Great.
Go, Brian. Okay.
One thing that should be mentioned with that as well is premier was quoted in a previous press session of having made that statement that it could potentially be used for evolution, but when being drilled in session, he wouldn't kind of repeat that.
He wouldn't
that.
Commit to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The Tories. Anyways.
Is that all the time we have, Sean?
It is, yes.
Okay.
And we do have our guests lined up on cue here, so.
Sadly cut off when I have so much more to say.
You have next week, though.
That's true.
You can continue
this. And the week after.
And maybe even the week after.
Maybe even.
We might keep them around that long.
Thanks, guys.
Does.
I can't wait to hear the interview.
Thanks, Brady.
Thank you.
All right. And now for our regularly scheduled commercial break.
Here we go.
Mm-hmm.
Here at Skeptically Speaking, we have a little slogan. Call in and question everything. Well, due to some technical challenges, we'll be asking you to reach us by email for tonight's show at live@skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also blast us your thoughts via Twitter to our account, Skeptical Radio. After tonight's show, you may comment on our blog at skepticallyspeaking.com. Our show is also available as a podcast on iTunes or also on our website. Again, that email is live@skepticallyspeaking.com. We look forward to getting your thoughts on air. And we're back.
And welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. We're here today with Dr. Ming Su to talk about fairness, efficiency, risk, reward, and why sometimes we can't make decisions about any of those things. Spoiler alert, blame your brain. Dr. Su is currently assistant professor of economics at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly. He's also affiliated faculty at the Beckman Institute, which is an interdisciplinary research institute at the UIUC. He received his PhD in economics from the California Institute of Technology, and his research interests are in the areas of behavioral economics and neuroeconomics. Welcome, Ming.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for being on the show.
No, thank you.
So, before researching for this show, I had never heard of neuroeconomics at all. Can you explain that to the audience?
Yes. Neuroeconomics started as a fusion of economics and neuroscience, not surprisingly, given its name. And it's mostly concerned with understanding the neural mechanisms behind economic decision-making, mostly. So if you think about the types of decisions we make when we buy gas, go to the grocery store, and all of those are, at one level or another, goes back to the implementation of our nervous system. So how do the different areas of our brain interact to assign values to, for example, common grocery goods that we are going to buy and undertake those kind of transactions, or to kind of more social and political decisions. So I mean, there's a kind of quite a gamut of areas that neuroeconomics has potential implications for.
Right.
But at this point, it's much more about kind of individual decision making.
Okay, so are there an increasing number of these kind of cross-disciplinary fields? Because it seems like I'm hearing a lot more about a lot of overlap between fields.
So I think there's a growing interest in fostering interdisciplinary research, in part to take advantage of the growing maturity of many of these sciences, like neuroscience or the biological sciences especially. And so the Beckman Institute is one of the institutes that has as its centering mission to promote this type of interdisciplinary research. And I think many institutions around the world are highly interested in kind of finding these synergies between the sciences.
What are some other examples, just for our audience?
An example of interdisciplinary research other than neuroeconomics?
Mm-hmm.
So some of the older ones would be biophysics, mm-hmm. And biochemistry. Those are probably the most successful, some of the most successful examples. Many of the pharmaceutical discoveries have been based on the biochemistry, the collaboration between biologists and chemists. The neuroeconomics, I think, is one of the kind of the current ones and the most nascent of these interdisciplinary endeavors.
Okay. So you fairly recently published a paper titled The Right and the Good, Distributive Justice and Neural Encoding of Equity and Efficiency. So, and just to give people a background, you wanted to test how the brain responds when confronted with issues of fairness versus how it deals with issues of efficiency?
Yes. So efficiency is sometimes a confusing term. So here we are. It's best to kind of restrict it to a very strict definition of economic efficiency, which is kind of the total number of total amount of goods or resources that are available. So the overall arch of the problem is you can think of standard debates in politics about how to maximize the social good. So whether in social good do you care about something like GDP per capita, Which is a kind of a gross measure of how much every on average people have. Or do you also take into account things like inequity? So how evenly unevenly the resources are being, or something like income is distributed in the country. So how much do you want to tax the rich, and how much do you want to distribute to the overall society? So sometimes most people would like for everyone to have more and for the growth to be relatively even. But sometimes these two goals come into conflict, and we have to have some way of resolving the two. So the example we give in our study was a rather stylized example, so a very kind of extreme example, where we asked people to donate to an orphanage, but some of the people that you're donating to had to get more than the other. And what you had to do is kind of arbitrate between who gets more and how evenly of the goods that you want to spread out between the people.
So I've sort of read some reviews of your work, and some people have referred to the fact that this was a brutal research piece to be a part of. It was very emotional.
Yeah, so it ended up being quite an emotional study, and it's quite emotionally engaging for our subjects, and the point was to get them to really care about the decisions that they make. So the experimental paradigm was which we actually gave the scenario to people. So you are donating to an orphanage in Africa. The people that you're donating to are the orphans at the orphanage. So suppose I give you 24 meals. This is approximately equal to $5. You have 24 meals that we give to each orphan, and what you have to do is you have to take away certain number of meals, and we force you to do that. So this is kind of where the trade-off starts. So that's kind of where the trade-off starts. And wow. So in one scenario, you can, for example, take away 12 meals from one kid. And in the other scenario, suppose you can take away 7 each from 2 kids, right? So you lose 12 in one case, but 14 in the other. So if you're just looking at something like economic efficiency, if you only care about the total number of meals that you're donating to the orphanage, you would take away 12, because at the end, you're donating more to the orphans when you take away only 12 versus 14. On the other hand, if you take away, if you look at the -7 and -7 scenario, the losses are more evenly distributed, right? So it's 7 from each kid as opposed to kind of 12 from just one kid. So depending on how you feel about inequity, you might decide to take away from one or two orphans, and by varying those numbers, the equity and the efficiency across the choices, we can kind of get some idea of how much people value equity and how much people value efficiency.
So why, neurologically, why exactly do people value things different ways like this?
You were kind of cutting off for a second.
What happens in the brain, basically, when people are trying to make these decisions?
Yeah, so that was the question that we went in asking, mm-hmm. and people were undergoing functional magnetic resonance imaging while they're making these decisions. So what we found was kind of distributed areas that are encoding for equity and efficiency separately, and that's what the title was, the encoding of equity and efficiency in the brain. So for economic efficiency, we found a region that's called the putamen. It's a part of the classic reward regions that have been very well implicated in both animal and human studies. So that areas of the brain is tracking kind of total efficiency, or the chosen efficiency of of people's decisions. So this region, for example, if you chose to take away 12, the activation of that area would be activated greater than if you took away 14 in total. So this area is kind of tracking the total amount that you're giving to the orphans without regard to the inequity that was inherent in the problem. There is another region of brain that's called the insula. That's more involved in emotional processing, and that area was activated by how much inequity was involved in your choices or your choices produced. So that area of the brain was paying attention to the inequity, but not the efficiency. So you kind of have these two parts of the brain that were separately coding for these two different economic variables. And most interestingly, we actually found a region that's called the caudate. That's also in the reward. That's also one of the classic reward regions. It's actually in the same broader area called the striatum. It's in the same part of the system as the putamen. And that part of the brain, the caudate, was driven by both the equity and the efficiency. So you kind of have this, so the brain kind of breaks apart these different economic dimensions that people are paying attention to, and then after you make the choice, it kind of puts it back together, and you kind of evaluate the, you evaluate the equity and efficiency of your choices in this one region. So this is what we are calling kind of a unified encoding of equity efficiency in the brain. So both separate and unified exist at different brain areas.
Okay, that's very interesting. I actually have an email question that seems to relate a lot to this idea of conflicting parts of the brains. The question goes, can the doctor describe the evolutionary history that would lead one to assume that there is even a part of the brain that would be concerned with economics? So essentially, you know, how did our brain come to want to process these things to begin with?
Yeah, so that's the broader view, the broader goal of this discipline, and there's a lot of details that we still don't know. There's some details, especially with very simple types of decision making. For example, how we value, say, food, liquid, etc., that we understand quite well, and those are the areas that some of which I've touched upon. For example, the caudate, which is responding to reward value and reward learning. The insula is involved in a wide variety of inequity, risk, type of emotionally engaging stimuli that we are sensitive to. There are other parts of the brain, including orbital frontal cortex, that seems to be especially involved in reward learning and also reward evaluation. So understanding how the different parts of the brain put together these different properties of economic decision making is one of the kind of the very difficult challenges, but is one that we are making quite a bit of progress on in the last 3 or 4 years that this area has really kind of taken off and becoming established. But to answer your question, there is no area in the brain that we can point to specifically and saying, this is the economic economic decision making area of the brain. It's kind of a network of regions that interact to produce these very subtle and complicated choices that people sometimes have to make.
Okay, going into this wiring, I do have another email question here. Basically, can either be wired for equity or efficiency, according to some studies. Can this wiring be altered over a lifetime naturally or by current or hypothetical medicine in the future?
So that's one of the things that we are studying, and it's actually an area that that doesn't get paid a lot of attention because most studies have been restricted to college undergraduates for obvious reasons. We are really trying to. So our study included people from 20 years old to 55 years old, and you do see that over time people tend to become a bit more inequity averse, which is to say they value inequity more as they get older. We don't know what happens towards kind of the even more extreme ends of the lifespan, like, you know, when people are in their 80s and 90s, that's an interesting question that we are trying to pursue right now. But the data looks like at this point people are getting more inequity averse over age. And interestingly, women have been found to be more inequity averse through both our study and in a much larger sample by Ernst Fair in Switzerland. So there are interesting gender and also age and, you know, probably cultural differences as well. But again, no, we don't know. We don't have the data currently right now to really make those statements.
Okay, cool. We have lots of email questions coming in here, so we'll just keep going at them. Are you familiar with some of the game theory studies on decision making? And if so, how well do they correlate with the work that you and your team are doing?
Yes. In fact, we are actively pursuing those studies right now. That's going to be one of the very interesting areas that quite a few economists are working on. Game theory adds a even more interesting wrinkle in that you are not just making decisions by yourself. So it's not just, you know, what kind of apple I'm going to buy. It's I'm going to be involving engaging in strategic decision making with another person. So I have to start thinking about how other people think. So you know, if you think about the standard prisoner's dilemma example, that I have to that if I want to cooperate with another person, because I want to get some the socially optimal solution, I have to imagine that the other person is also going to engage in this kind of pro-social behavior, that he's not a selfish person, in which case he will take all the money and I will be left as kind of the sucker. So you have to have an accurate mental model of other people's decisions to be able to play well in a game theoretic setting. And the problems there are, you know, become much more complicated you can just tell from this example. And we have some ideas about, you know, how people mentalize others. For example, the superior temporal sulcus, which is involved in mentalizing and thinking about other people's intentions. That area is reliably activated when people are engaging in game theoretic experiments. On the other hand, the deeper questions of what are they exactly mentalizing about? You know, what intentions am I actually putting on the other person? Those we don't know very well yet. So we kind of have some idea of what areas are activated, but we don't quite know what functions are should be attached to those areas.
Okay, kind of on I think it's a similar note. You're familiar with the trolley problem?
Yes.
Okay, just to review it for our listeners here, a trolley is running out of control down a track. In its path are five people who have been tied to the track. Fortunately, you can flip a switch, which will lead the trolley down a different track to safety. Unfortunately, there is a single person tied to that track, should you flip the switch. So the listener was basically asking if your research relates to this problem.
Yes. So the trolley dilemma was actually what partly motivated our equity and efficiency study. So that's the original trolley neuroimaging experiment was carried out by Josh Green, who was a postdoc at Princeton at the time in Jonathan Cohen's lab. So we wanted to understand some of the economic reasoning behind the trolley dilemma. So one line of kind of what you might think of as, you know, sort of dismal economic reasoning exercise that we went through is most people are willing to push a pushing a person down a footbridge. Most people are not willing to push down a person to down a footbridge to have the track run over the person and save five people on the track. Right. So the kind of the morbid economic trade-off that you might imagine asking people making is that instead of there being just five people, now imagine there are 100 people, right, or 1,000 people. So at some point, as I increase the number of people that are at stake, you might be willing to start contemplating actually pushing a man down a footbridge to save those, say, 1,000, 10,000, million lives. So we wanted to really get at how do people make these trade-offs between, you know, saving a person and the social welfare of saving a person versus emotionally repugnant choice of pushing a person down a footbridge. So that's partly what motivated the question of these equity inefficiencies. So you can think of, you know, taking meals away from orphans as being kind of morally repugnant, but on the other hand, you are doing quite a bit of good because in the end you are donating to quite a bit of money to the orphanage. So the trolley dilemma was very much behind our thinking, and it was to kind of put an economic perspective on these type of ethical decisions.
Now, before I get to that, first of all, the person who keeps calling the studio, the phones don't work. Please, please do email in. That's live@skepticallyspeaking.com. You look very eager. Get to a computer. So, in relation to that, I do find it interesting because it's one thing to do a study and to find out what people say they would do, but how does that relate to real life? Like, you can say you would, you know, push somebody in front of a train to save other people, but how do you figure out if that would actually relate, if somebody would actually do that?
So we went to some length to obtain the consent of the orphanage to allow us to donate to the orphanage according to people's choices. So we had we tried to go beyond a simple hypothetical scenario where you're just imagining in your head what's going to happen as say you're making life and death decisions, and we actually tried to implement decisions that people actually make. So the interesting experiment would be to compare hypothetical and real life decisions and see exactly what the areas of the brain are different, because in part these haven't been done, which you might think are extremely obvious experiments but partly it comes from the difference in background between economists and psychologists.
Right.
And whereas psychologists are much more interested in kind of these very abstract thought experiments, economists are much more interested in decisions where, you know, people actually make decisions that have real outcomes attached to them. So a convergence of those two approaches is currently, there are actually a couple of labs that are doing that right now, but as of this point, we don't really know the exact differences.
Okay, now how can we tangibly apply this kind of research?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
How can we apply this research?
So many of this research is quite abstract and quite basic. Some of the areas that are most applied would be the translational areas to, for example, aging and those with mental illnesses. So many of the neurological degradations are particularly impact social decision making and social behavior. So to the extent that we have a better understanding of those kind of social aspects of people's functioning, we can say maybe, you know, understand why it is that, for example, sociopaths are not understanding or don't respond to, say, punishment, rewards, social interactions. To the degree that normal people do. And we can also understand, have diagnosis for when people are aging and when your neurological health starts to degrade, what kind of social decision making and what kind of social interactions are people being impaired. So I think the translation areas are first going to be in the public health areas. Beyond that, you might start thinking about how to design artificial intelligence agents using some of the research that we're doing, and people are starting to do that as well.
Well, actually, on that note, I was reading another study that you were a part of, the Neurobiological Foundations of Valuation in Human Decision-Making Under Uncertainty. And you were talking about trying to figure out a way to predict people's choices in complex situations, specifically relating to risk versus reward. And one of the reasons that you were researching this is specifically for use in AI.
Yes, that's exactly right. So if you think about the models that we have currently of investment, many of them have very kind of very rigid notions of risk and uncertainty. And part of this research can be seen as some people have called it neurofinance, is to put a more human interface behind these mathematical notions of risk and uncertainty. So much of the, take the current financial crisis, much of the blame is being laid on risk models that are too crude and not capturing all of the various different types of risks and uncertainties that are out there in the environment. And so part of the inspiration for this research is to provide the scientific basis for, you know, for if I had a stock trader who's actually in the trading room, how would he respond to the risks that the machines are not picking up? So that would have far-reaching implications if they were implemented in the real world, and that's something that, you know, hopefully one day we will live to see that.
Well, in the study, I found it interesting that you spoke about how valuation is different than choice, how we continually evaluate, but choice is a different thing. Can you explain?
Yes. Yes. So if you think about as we walk through, or probably the best example is when we are going to college. So when we're picking up education, there are lots of choices that we don't make. So, for example, we don't make a choice at any moment to go into a new career. On the other hand, our mind is probably constantly keeping track of the value of various occupations, various career choices that we have. And at some point, and the hope is at some point in the future, those valuations are going to help us when we actually have to make these decisions. So the brain you can think of as constantly valuing, but the choices might be few and far in between. So the mapping from values and choices might not be as clear-cut as economists might have thought in the past, which is kind of a very values only occur to the extent that we make choices. But some of that gets kind of into esoteric philosophical arguments that probably isn't of interest to, you know, the general audience.
Well, I do have a question that almost goes right into that wording. What implications does this research have for the philosophical field of ethics versus the economical field?
So the philosophical implications are actually traces back all the way to probably the greatest the philosophers in every civilization in history, and the most influential ones in the past have been Aristotle and Kant, who talked about this idea of having differences between having this deontological, so kind of having this rule based ethical decisions, such that you have kind of norms and maxims, such like, you know, don't harm people, don't kill people, and those rules as being the arbiter or the definition of justice, of ethics. On the other hand, you have these utilitarian arguments about, for example, just summing up. So Jeremy Bentham would be the great advocate of a social utility argument, which kind of sums up everyone's happiness, and whatever choices that maximizes this sum ought to be implemented. So without regard to sort of these rules that people, that society might have. So, for example, if you have to, say, do some odious tasks like execute some people or tax a certain group extremely unfairly, that would be okay if the outcome were to maximize this total happiness in a country, for example. And so there are kind of these debates about whether these norms have do exist. And in the brain, it does look like people are engaging in utilitarian choices, but also they do have these norms or rules like fairness, which limit or which impact their decision making. So it kind of reconciles in some ways these utilitarian and deontological perspectives in ethical decision making.
Great. Okay, we're going to take a very short break here just to sneak in our promo for next week, and we'll just be back with you in about a minute, Doctor.
Thank you.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be discussing skeptical activism with Tim Farley. Tim is the creator of What's the Harm, a website that details the sometimes frightening human cost of belief in the paranormal or pseudoscience. He is also the author of SkepTools.com, a blog dedicated to developing tools and techniques that skeptics can use in the battle against misinformation on the internet. If you've always wondered what you could do personally to stem the rising tide of irrationality, rather than just arguing with your in-laws at family gatherings, then join us on the next Skeptically Speaking every Friday at 6 p.m. here on CJSR.
And you're back with Skeptically Speaking. You can possibly sneak in another question at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or at Twitter at
Skeptical Radio.
I knew that.
And our phones are not working, so those are your only means of communicating with us this evening.
Sorry, guys. This is going to be going on for a couple weeks until our new phones are delivered. So one of the things that I think a lot of people would want to know about this is, are we trying to remove that emotional response? Are we trying to remove that fairness? Would it make things easier if we were only focused on the efficiency part of this equation?
Sometimes one might want to do that, but in general, we think of emotions as being part of the adaptive response. So we have emotions for a reason, and part of that is to part of that may be to represent some things that are important to us. For example, justice, fairness, being treated well by others, and to the extent that those are important to us, it doesn't make it not part of our preference. It constitutes and what makes up our what we like and dislike, and you know, makes us human in some ways. So, of course, there are times when we have well documented examples where emotions might be maladaptive, and one might want to sort of suppress those responses. So, for example, we have a study on loss aversion, where people are taking disadvantageous gambles because of the emotional response, because of the fear of the loss that lets them that causes them or leads them to miss out on good opportunities to actually make money. So by having people taper down those emotional responses by using simple cognitive strategies, we show that that people are actually making more optimal choices from an economic decision making point of view. So, for example, you make more money in the long run by suppressing your emotional choices, but emotional responses. But obviously, you know, you can't. Suggestion to take that all the way and eliminate one's emotional responses. So there are examples and counterexamples to both arguments.
Okay, we have another question here. Do you believe that as a result of continuing studies on the subject, it will one day be possible to chart a person's personality, perhaps by measuring their neurological predispositions to emotions in some standardized way? You might have a 5 in wisdom and a
7 in apathy or something like that.
Someone's talking about D&D right there.
Is yeah. It?
Definitely.
That's, I think that will be, I mean, I suppose technically that's possible, but I think that will be a long ways away. I think a good analogy would be the gene mapping program. So, you know, we mapped all the genes, but we don't really know what, most of them do. And I think the bottom line is that the brain is going to be too complicated to put into very simple, paradigms like, you know, five, you know, personalities or seven of something else, that it will be kind of a very complicated system that's not only biological but also interacts with the environment in unforeseen and complicated ways. So two people, so even if we could map out the neurological substrate for decision making, the experience that people undertake would probably take them to very different and unpredictable directions. So I think that the difficult, so those are going to be, and I think that that's a trend for most of the biological most of the biological answers to kind of to these questions.
So what are you working on right now?
So right now I'm working, we're working on quite a few different areas. So part of it is to further the study of equity and efficiency, and partly is actually some of the questions that your readers have emailed in are exactly the things that we have been researching. So for example, the differences across the lifespan in how people make these equity fairness decisions, and also in game theory. And for example, how people understand intentions in games, how do people strategize in interactive decision makings, or how people learn in games. So all of those things are part of our part of our research agenda right now. So I think it'll be it'll be a little while before we get those papers out, but I think it'll be quite interesting once we do finish them.
And all of this is with the Beckman Institute?
Yes. So partly this is at the Beckman Institute, and others with my collaborators at Caltech, and also with people at the NYU, where with Liz Phelps' lab, where we did the loss aversion study that I mentioned earlier about controlling one's emotional reactions. So there's quite a big group. It's a tight knit and a growing group of neuroeconomists that I'm a part of, and I think and much of this is collaborating with them.
Okay, now I have a question that I like to ask people when I think they might have something interesting to say. Do you have a theme song when you walk along the street, by any chance? Like a certain song that plays in your head?
A certain song that plays in my head?
Absolutely.
It will be whatever music I'm listening at the time. That I have been listening throughout this past couple of weeks, I guess. Right now, there's a song stuck in my head. It's kind of an odd one. It's by a band called Dengue Fever. It's kind of this interesting mix of
nice.
Psychedelic rock and Cambodian pop songs, and it's very interesting and. Yeah, so right now that's what's kind of going through my head in the mornings and sometimes, when I walk.
Is there any overarching theme song that runs through your life if you had to choose one?
We've had some really interesting responses to this question, so we're just going to continue to ask it.
Yeah, we're relaxed.
I'll have to get back to you on that. I really
that's
haven't
fair.
Thought about it.
Specifically, yeah. We're looking for that song that makes you strut. When you walk
Sorry?
Along the sidewalk, the song that makes you strut.
That makes me strut?
Strut. Strutting is the key. So it's got to have a good beat. It's got to have some kind of possible emotional resonance.
Uh-huh.
It's okay. You can work on it.
Well, luckily, yeah. Dr. Sue might be off the hook here. We are actually running quickly out of
okay.
time here tonight. So we thank you for coming on to Skeptically Speaking this evening. To all of our listeners out there, thanks for tuning in as always, and I'll leave Des with the final words here.
Well, thanks to Dr. Sue, definitely. And thanks also to the ever-wonderful Jill for being so bloody opinionated and actually coming on the radio. I know she was not thrilled initially, but I think she had fun. And also thanks for all the tweets and emails and the patients with no phones. And we will see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
See you then, everyone.
Thank you.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for